In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcasts and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of series 2 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And another beautiful day out there, Helen. It really does feel over the last couple of weeks as if we've turned a corner.
Well, Liz, it's so funny because I turned my heating off on Easter because it was such a beautiful Easter weekend of the sun. You know, really, it was warm. So I turned my heating off. I thought, that's it. It's now the summer. Well, yesterday I was walking in St. Andrews with a group of people and we had hailstones, little balls of ice falling on top of us. But I thought, oh, that's an extra fleece, not the heating. I'm going to be determined. No heating until next summer. Well, no, till the winter.
Well, that reminds me of when I used to travel with work in a previous life through schools in China, and they had a rule about being north of the Yangtze, or maybe it was south of the Yangtze, I can't remember, half a story as usual, but they had a special date in October where they had to wait until they turned the heating on, and of course it could be absolutely perishing before that date, but they weren't allowed, so you'd go in and all the kids would be sitting in about six layers of thick fleeces and whatever because it hadn't reached the date for the heating going on. So it's the same in your house.
It's the same in our house. And of course, in the old days, without central heating or anything, it was put the fire on or not put the fire on. And it depended whether you had coal in the bunker or not, whether you put the fire on. And the coal was normally sort of brought in readiness for the winter. So during the summer, there was very little coal in the bunker.
Yeah, it's true.
A good word. There's a good word, bunker.
The coal bunker, yeah.
Yes.
The scuttle, coal scuttle as well. You brought it in the coal scuttle. We're using up all these words already. But it's very much about the direction of the wind, isn't it? I mean, the wind has changed and it was definitely from the north yesterday. It was bitterly cold, although it was a lovely day.
It was beautiful. It was just stunning. And yes, and that's, I think, what a lot of people coming here don't really realise, that it's not so much the low temperature, it's the wind chill factor.
Definitely. Yes, so plenty, always have plenty of layers in Scotland. But, you know, the topic for this week's episode, we're beginning to the start of coronation fever.
Oh, yes, and it's really, you know, hotting up. We're being released on a daily basis, little nuggets of information about what is going to be happening on the coronation day or the coronation weekend, I suppose it is.
Yeah,
we know that Prince Charles is going to be using the very smart, modern, up-to-date new coach on his way to the coronation. But on the way back, it's the old rickety 1600s coach.
Yeah, I mean,
Made of gold, of course.
Of course. I don't think we've really got into it yet in Scotland. I mean, I think they're hopeful that on the Sunday of the coronation weekend, we all engage with street parties and garden events and whatever. And I don't think, I haven't seen anything planned by local authorities or local neighbourhoods or anything yet. So I think there's a bit of time for that.
But it's not a very Scottish thing, parties, is it?
No,
so
we don't have
I think people will celebrate in their own back gardens. We're a bit more sort of reserved. The English will be out, whole streets lined with tables and sandwiches.
Flags, yes, yeah. I mean, I know that the Salon Golf Club has got something going on, so I suppose that it is. You're talking about little nuggets. I mean, yesterday it was a huge, great chunk because we got the announcement that Harry was coming.
Oh, yes, that's that. Okay, I'm very pleased that he is, Liz. Yes. I'm very pleased that he is. I just hope, and this is what they were saying on the news last night, hope that attention is not diverted from the main event just to look at Harry.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like to be in his shoes walking into the family dinner. I was just imagining it. You can imagine Catherine, the peacemaker, you know, she always tries to smooth everything over and whatever, but awkward.
It's a bit like choosing where the wedding guests are going to sit at your wedding, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, you can't sit Auntie Mary next to them because they haven't spoken for 20 years.
This is true. Yeah, but it's an important point in the life of the nation. And it's good. I mean, a lot of people will criticise it for how much it's costing. I mean, you were talking there about how the coach is being scaled down. I mean, when the Queen's coronation took place in 1953, 8,000 people attended and the service was 3 hours long. So when you work out how much that cost in today's money, that was equivalent to about 46 to 50 million pounds.
Yes, no, I think Prince Charles is scaling, or Prince King Charles, sorry, King Charles is scaling quite a bit down. But even the costs, although he's scaling it down, the costs are still ridiculously high. But it's a big event, one off. I mean, Liz, I know this is your first coronation. It's my second.
How much do you remember of the first?
I don't remember a great deal, Liz, but I do remember that at school we got little tin boxes about the size of a very thin pencil case would hold about 3-4 pencils. We got those and there were coronation pens, ballpoint pens, and we all got these little pencil case things. Some had pencils in and some had little bits of chocolate in, you know. So I remember all these little gifts. Everybody got a little gift for the coronation.
Very nice. And have you still got yours?
No, but I had to fairly recently, just the box, not the chocolate, of course, but just the box. I had it till very recently, and who knows, it might be packed away in a safe place somewhere amongst the boxes in the loft.
For somebody else to find as an antique.
Exactly, yes.
Well, I wasn't around, as I say, but, you know, the stories are apocryphal, isn't that the word that come down? I mean, I said in the last episode that my gran was one of 13 children and that several of her brothers went off to Canada, but the sisters were left at home. And one sister in particular was the sister who became the spinster, I hate that word, and stayed at home to look after the father, the elderly father. So when he died, she was well on, I don't know what age she would be, ancient, probably in her 50s when we think of it now. And she married a widower who had his own business, who was quite wealthy. So they purchased one of the first televisions. And so for the coronation, they invited, I don't think they sold tickets, but it was just about like that, whether you got the invitation or not, to go down to the front room, the parlour, and watch the coronation on television. And so my mum and dad, they watched it in the parlour with the rest of the family. So that was quite an important event.
It was, and we didn't have a television for the coronation. So, and I know that we watched it, so we must have gone round to neighbours. And as you say, in the parlour, you know, family sitting cross-legged in front of the telly there on the floor, the children on the floor. And it was, you know, we think of televisions now with these massive screens, but these screens were probably only about 12-inch maximum screens. You know, there were tiny little things, and the sound was not good, and it was in black and white.
Yeah, it probably looked as if it was snowing down in London as well.
Well, it was raining. It was really raining. And the Queen of Tonga, Queen Salotti of Tonga, she insisted in riding in the carriage with the roof, with the hood down, so people could see her and she could see the people. And it's, you know, that's a real image of the Queen's coronation, is Queen Salotti of Tonga in the pouring rain, just smiling and waving to the crowds. She was beautiful, lovely, big, statuesque lady.
Very nice. Well, my abiding memory is much more contemporary, because, of course, it was from the coronation that we get your favourite baked potato filling, coronation chicken.
Yes. In fact, I had a coronation chicken butty the other day.
Lovely. I love it.
I wonder what King Charles is going to have.
Yeah, something
because
that
there will be something come out.
Absolutely. No, coronation chicken, for those that don't know, is kind of mayonnaise curried. But the important thing was that it was apricots in it as well. So very nice, either on a butty or on a baked potato. So
yes.
Come on, Charles, what are you coming up with?
Yeah, and the thing with the dish that they come up with, it's got to be representative of the whole of the Commonwealth. So this is why it wasn't just chicken, it was the mayonnaise, it was the curry, it was the apricots, it was all things from that everybody in the Commonwealth could eat.
Right, I never thought of that.
Yes.
Very true, yeah.
So this is why it'll be really interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, so am I. So we'll, by the time we record our next episode, it'll all be past, so we'll do our reflections on what happens. But,
right.
I mean, they're throwing everything at it. I mean, even with a scaled-down event, it's estimated that it'll cost over £100 million. And who pays for that? Well, because it's a state event, it's the UK government, so it's the British taxpayers, us, that will be paying for it. But they reckon that, you know, it's such a global event that the TV rights that they'll get worldwide will more than cover the cost. And of course, we'll also get, hopefully, a massive boost for tourism.
Yes. And I think there will be quite a number of people coming over just to be here for the event, whether they're in London or anywhere, because there will be big screens erected, I would imagine, in the parks up and down the country to let people see the coronation.
Yeah, but it is a very special moment in the life of our nation, in the life of the United Kingdom, Scotland taking its place in that. And of course, there's a lot of tradition, there's religious, symbolic tradition, and none more so than in Scotland. And one of the strong traditions that we have that involves the coronation is the place played by the Stone of Destiny.
Yes, it's the Stone of Destiny or Stone of Scone. This was a big lump of sandstone, Liz, isn't it? It's just, it has nothing to look at all, but it is almost more precious than the Honours of Scotland, the Crown Jewels, or anything you can think of. Much more precious than that, the Stone of Destiny.
Yeah, and of course, for visitors who've already been to Scotland, if they've gone to Edinburgh Castle and waited in the queues, they will have passed through the Crown Jewels, the Honours of Scotland. And it always amazes me that sitting right beside these beautiful gems, all these diamonds and precious stones and huge great big pearls the size of grapes, as they pass through, there's this muckle great block of stone, an oblong and this kind of reddy, sandy-coloured sandstone. And you might say, well, what on earth is that doing sitting under lock and key with lasers focused down on it and all the rest of it? But it's such an important symbol to Scotland. And yeah, so that's the topic for our episode today.
Yes, and this stone has got so many wonderful legends attached to it. If we kind of go back, why it's important, it is the stone on which the kings of Scotland were crowned. And that is about 38 kings of Scotland were crowned on the Stone of Destiny. And it came over from the west of Scotland with Kenneth MacAlpine in the 9th century and came to Scone, which is in Perthshire, just outside Perth. And it sat there right through until 1296. But people say, or the legend says, it came from even further afield than the west of Scotland. It came over from Ireland to the west of Scotland. And where did it come from? To Ireland. It came even from Syria. So it's got huge legends, and there's a Jacob legend as well, Liz, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about it as if it's a statement of fact. But of course, going back to those sort of time zones, we're talking about prehistory, the written word, really. And so we're dependent on legends. And as you say, one of the most important legends that's associated with it is a Celtic legend. We've talked about the Celts before, but they believed that the stone actually dated right back to biblical times. And that, in fact, it was the pillow on which Jacob rested at Bethel. And if you remember the story from the Bible in Genesis, he went to sleep with his head resting on the stone, and he had a dream where he witnessed angels ascending into heaven. He was climbing a ladder. And so according to the Jewish legend, he anointed the stone, and some believe that it became the pedestal for the Ark of the Covenant in the Temple of Solomon, and that it was brought from Syria, first of all, to Egypt, and then it was moved on when the Egyptian army was defeated. A king called Gaethelus, the original Gallic king, a Greek prince, he fled to Spain. And it's said that his wife was a daughter of one of the pharaohs of Egypt called Scota. And so the legend comes that when they brought the stone to Scotland, that's where we get Scotia and eventually Scotland from. Although I think that's probably a wee bit tenuous.
Yeah, but they're lovely stories, Liz.
Absolutely.
You know, tenuous or not, they're just lovely stories. And that kind of helps to add to the importance and just myth and preciousness of the Stone of Destiny.
Yeah, and it's said that St. Patrick blessed the stone and it was used for as a coronation stone for the kings of Ireland. But by the time we get to, you were talking about Kenneth MacAlpin, Kenneth I in the 9th century, we do have more accurate historical records. So we are on much more solid ground as we get to the kings of Dalriada. Do you say Dalriada or Dalriada?
I say Dalriada.
But
I'm not sure what is correct.
Well, what we do know is that when the kingdom of Dalriada was formed on the west coast of Scotland in what's now Argyll, this brought together the Scots, who are from the west, and the Picts from the northeast, and Scotland became united for the first time as the country that would become Scotland.
Yes, I think that's the important thing about Kenneth MacAlpine. He gave us the shape of Scotland more or less as we know it today, and then he brought the stone over from more to the centre of Scotland. We say to the west, but Scone Palace is more central than west. Yeah. And he placed it there and made his headquarters in that area.
Yeah, I think at first it was on the west coast. You know, Dunad and where's the other one?
Dunstaffnage.
Yeah. Yes. So that but it was those Vikings, they kept on raiding. And they were such a nuisance that I think that they decided, let's get away from the coast, let's make them work for their money and move it inland to the most central part of Scotland, to Scone.
Yes. And you know, and it was there for about 400 years or so until things began to happen. And at, when it was there, as I said, 38 kings were not at Scone, but 38 kings crowned there. So that's very important. And the last king to be crowned at Scone on the Stone of Destiny was, or at Scone, sorry, not on the Stone of Destiny, at Scone. On the Stone of Destiny was John Baliol, who was the king during the Wars of Independence. But there was another king crowned at Scone. It was Charles II in 1651.
Yeah, and we'll probably pick up on that in the next episode when we look at Scottish coronations down
coronation
history.
Yes.
But I think it's important that, you know, you think of a great big lump of stone sitting on a hillside, because part of the ceremony of the coronations, the ancient coronation of kings, was that it all took place on a hill called Moot Hill. But the stone wasn't kept there. It was kept in the local church, or by that time it was a monastery, an abbey. And it was taken out for these enthronements. And probably they would have put a fancy embroidered cloth on it for the king to sit on. And through time, they believed that they actually put it into a wooden throne. And that's what first became a royal coronation chair. So it was a bit cold and drafty and uncomfortable sitting on a lump of rock, even with an embroidered cloth on it. So that, let's give them their comforts. Let's make it a wooden throne.
Yes. And it was you there sitting on, or at Moot Hill, or in the abbey at Scone, that in the 13th century, the late 13th century, Edward I, who was trying to take over Scotland at this point in what was known as our Wars of Independence. Some of you may have seen the film Braveheart, which is set during that time. Historically, but it was set during this time. And Edward I, who tried very hard, he'd taken castles, he'd, you know, really defeated the Scots all over the place. But he thought the Scots were like little, you know, these little toy weevils that you used to get, knock them down and they bounce straight back up again. This is what was happening to the Scots. And Edward thought, what can I do that will really, really, really upset them? I will take their precious stone from Scone and take it down to England. And that's what he did. But, as they say, Liz, but you carry on.
No, it's just, as you say, it was the ultimate humiliation. I mean, you said there that John Baliol was the last Scottish king to be crowned on the stone in 1292. And he was known in Scottish history as Tomb Tabard, because Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots, literally stripped the coat off him when he found out that he'd been plotting against Edward. So he wasn't a happy man. And so he decided that he would teach these Scots a lesson. And as you say, the best lesson would be to take away one of their most symbolic artifacts. So he came north And he took away the Stone of Destiny, the Stone of Scone, and brought it back down to Westminster Abbey, where he had his own special coronation chair made. And he put the stone into this chair so that he was literally sitting over the Scots. He was being crowned as King of Scotland, or any future monarchs would be crowned as King of Scotland as well as England. So it was a symbol of his dominion over the Scots.
Yes, and it was at the coronation chair. I was in Westminster Abbey last year and saw the chair, and I had a lovely wee story there. The group I was with, I'd had in Scotland and taken them to Edinburgh Castle, explained all about the story of the Stone of Destiny, the Stone of Scone, and how Edward had built the coronation chair for it. Well, when we were down in Westminster Abbey, we had a guide in Westminster Abbey, an excellent guide. She was very, very good. But when she was telling the story of the coronation chair, she said something about, and Edward brought the stone down from Scotland to put, you know, to build the chair for the stone. And one of my guests, who'd heard my story in Edinburgh, said, "No, he stole the stone." And I said, "Oh, I've taught you well."
He removed it. Yeah. Whether or not, yes. Yeah, but as you say, did he remove it? Because we've had all the legends and myths about its provenance, where it actually came from, but there's just as much myth and legend about its appearance and whether or not this is actually the real stone on which the kings of Scotland were crowned for 400 years.
Yes, because the stories, or the information we have of the real stone, is it was a black shiny stone, and it had a kind of a seat, carved out with a little bit of seat in it. And Sir Walter Scott was always confident that what was down in Westminster Abbey in his day under the coronation chair was not the real stone, the stone that had come from the West, the stone that had come from Ireland. And there is another wee story associated with that. It is said that Sir Walter Scott found the real stone, so he believed, and sent it down to London to be tested, and it's disappeared. So perhaps hidden in the bowels of Buckingham Palace, we might find the stone.
Yeah, he was a master of fiction, was old Sir Walter Scott. Yeah, he liked to find these things. But I think now that we've got the access to modern techniques, we know a lot more. And we certainly know that the coronation stone, the Stone of Destiny, Stone of Scone that we have at present, is made of sandstone, which is found round about the Scone area. So it's not your fancy marbles or your fancy black stones or any stones that would have been connected with Egypt or Syria or anywhere else. It is a common old sandstone stone from around the area of Scone. So, that brings into question, was this original great stone, which they claim was ornately carved, or is it just a simple block of sandstone?
Yes, and you can imagine, Liz, the monks in the abbey at Scone who had they were looking after the Stone of Destiny, and they sort of thought, oh, crikey, here comes Edward, what are we going to do? And they just take, hide the real stone and just grab any stone they can find and put it out in the open for Edward to find and take away. So perhaps, like many other things, they put it and hid it in a safe place, and it's long forgotten where that safe place is.
Just like your pencil case from the coronation. Yep,
exactly.
Somebody else discover it. Well, it was Edward I wasn't there with it. It was his army. And, they find the stone in the abbey, and you can imagine, well, this is it. This is what the boss wants. Take it back down again. But the story does go that Edward I himself was never quite convinced that this was the correct stone. And so he did come back again a couple of years later and sack the abbey again, still having the belief that, I've got my suspicions. Sahima doots,
yes, no, it's I just love the whole, it's kind of Loch Ness monster, isn't it? It's just a wonderful story full of myth, legend and wondering, is it or is it not?
But right down through history, it's been a tangible symbol of Scotland and England, unification, separation, whatever. It's a very, very symbolic stone. And so it's been the focus for a lot of political turmoil, particularly with the establishment of the Scottish National Party in the 1950s. This sort of became a symbol of nationhood.
Yes, and that's where we have the wonderful story of the which in today's world of high security everywhere, it's almost an impossible to understand story. Four students from Glasgow University decided that they were going down during their Christmas holidays to Westminster Abbey and bring the stone back up to Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of it now, when you think of the security and whatever, they said that there was one security guard and he was more interested in his sandwiches and his cup of tea than he was in the stone. So relatively easily, when you consider the huge weight of this stone, they managed to extricate it from the seat down in Westminster Abbey and get it up the road to Scotland. Not so easy, though.
Not so easy, Liz, because when they were taking it out of underneath the coronation chair, they actually had to break one of the sides to get it out. And then they realised just how heavy the stone was. So the two students who were inside the abbey to bring it out, you know, they just couldn't manage it. So they thought they put down their raincoat, put the stone on top of the coat and used that as a slide to pull it up the aisle and out to the waiting car. The waiting car that had the other two students, Kay Matheson and one of the men, and a policeman was doing his rounds outside the Westminster Abbey. And he knocked on the window of the car where the two students were. They sort of said, Merry Christmas to you all. Happy New Year. Have a good time. So, and walked on his way, little knowing this was the getaway car.
And of course, they didn't manage to get it intact because in the process of all this manhandling and jammying it out of its position, the stone broke into two. And I actually think that it might have been that back in 1914, when the suffragettes were campaigning for the vote in protest on behalf of women's rights, they exploded a bomb which damaged the top of the chair. And so it could have been that the blast that caused that, you know, that the suffragists set off, had caused a crack in the stone. And it was only when the students started to try to take it out that it broke into two.
Can you imagine their faces, Liz, when they dropped and it broke in two?
Oops.
Oh dear.
I think it's like, you know, you've got these films these days about the gold heist and all of that. You can just imagine them. You know, once the whistle was blown, the bobby found that it was missing. You know, it was an absolute furore raging across the country. You know, where had it gone? Who had taken it? Roadblocks put up everywhere. And they were very astute, these students, and they realised that people would probably associate the stone with going back to Scotland. And so the roadblocks would be focused on vehicles going north. And so they decided, we'll go south. So they went south to Kent and they buried the biggest part of the stone in a field in Kent and thought, well, we'll wait until the heat dies down a wee bit and we'll come back and get it then.
Yes, and when they did that, they went up to Scotland and then returned to Kent. They were clever enough to remember exactly where, which field they'd buried it in. But when they got down there, they found that a group of travelling people were encamped just where they wanted to dig up their stone. So they waited and they waited. And then they thought, well, these people have got the same kind of a relationship with the English government as we have, so we'll risk it and go and speak to them. So they went in and spoke to the head man, who said, right, OK, just wait. We're actually entertaining the high hegians from the local area. So when they've gone, we'll give you a hand and we'll help you dig up your treasure. And that's exactly what happened. And they managed to get it up to Scotland. Stopping on the way at Birmingham, Liz, one of the students who were taking it up, back up to Scotland, had an aunt who lived in Birmingham. So they stopped there to stay the night and with his aunt, and she said, oh, come away and I've got some friends in for dinner, but there's plenty to eat. Come in. And so sitting around the table were some of her friends, one of which was one of the senior policemen in Birmingham. And of course, the chat at the table was all about the stone. And oh, says the policeman, oh, we know what's going on with that. We're on their tail. We'll get them. And the students were thinking, well, it's in the boot of our car, sitting next to your car in the drive of the house. So But he didn't catch on, and they did get back up to Scotland with it.
They did, and they took it to another staunch Scottish nationalist, a man called Robert Gray. He was a stonemason, and they said, look, we've got a problem here. We've broken our stone. Can you do something? So he made the necessary repairs. And of course, then you get another layer of the myth and legend, because did he give back the original, or did he make a replica and pass the replica back? So it's getting more and more complicated. Yeah. As we go down the tale here. But one way or another, they did think, you know, this is too hot to handle. We've got to get this back. So the story goes that they went to Scone, back to where, you know, the traditional Scone Palace, but then it was occupied by a girls' boarding school. And a bit like your visitors at dinner, when the law-abiding headmistress heard about this, she said, no way, you know, this is not coming on to school property. So she gave them short shrift, and eventually they took it back to another symbol of where it had come from, and that was Arbroath Abbey, because that was where the National Declaration,
Declaration of Independence, yes.
Yes, was signed. No, the Declaration of Arbroath, of Arbroath in 1320. That's where it was signed. So it was left there and duly handed back over to Westminster government, who had it returned to Westminster Abbey.
It's a wee bit like the monks at Scone. You can imagine the custodian's face when he's doing his rounds in the morning at Arbroath Abbey, and he comes across this lump wrapped in the flag, and he sort of phones up his boss and says, you'll never guess what I think I've found. I think I found that missing stone.
Yeah. But those four students have gone down in legend. I mean, they are part of Scottish history, and four very, very interesting people. I think you knew Kay Matheson, didn't you, Helen?
Yes. We went to visit her up in Gairloch, up in Pool U, where she lived. The story is that she was a domestic science teacher, home economics teacher at Gairloch High School. And my neighbour in Elgin was the retired head teacher at that school. So he'd asked us to take up to Gairloch, because we were going on holiday up there, a Gaelic Bible for Kay. So we went over and she invited us in for tea. A very, very interesting lady, really interesting lady. And she gave me a suitcase filled with all the cuttings and newspaper cuttings, letters, invitation cards, everything to do with the escapade in 1950. And she said, you can have that, take that, but you must bring it back to me tomorrow. Uh-huh. So I sat up all night reading all this stuff of Kay Matheson. And I'm very pleased to say that it seems to have, she's now sadly died, but it seems to have found its way to Gairloch Museum, where she was a founding member of the Gairloch Museum, and so her stuff would land up there. So I'm pleased about that.
Yeah, quite a character. You know, she was the only woman. She was studying domestic science in Glasgow at the time. We were all four students, but she was the one that drove the getaway car. She was the driver. There was two cars, but she was the driver. So absolutely, you know,
And I think she was chosen, Liz, because coming from Pool U, she'd been driving tractors and things since she was able to walk. So she was quite comfortable driving. And but yes, a woman driving the getaway car in the 1950s.
Great. And then probably what you could consider the ringleader, I suppose, was Ian Robertson Hamilton. And what's very interesting, you talked about how Kay went on to be so influential in Gairloch Museum and in the Gaelic culture of West, the Highlands of Scotland. But Ian Robertson Hamilton went on to be a very prestigious Scottish lawyer, a KC, was a nationalist all his days. But he was actually studying law at Glasgow University when this all happened. But what's notable after it is that they all went on to do great things, you know, in his case, to be a KC.
King's Counsellor.
King's Counsellor, yep. Prestigious Scottish lawyer.
I think that was the thing, because I think it was known that if the charges had been brought against these students, it would have really sort of, you know, lit the blue touch paper and the whole thing would have gone up, kind of thing. It was just not a good idea to do that.
Yeah, so only Ian Hamilton was the only one that didn't admit to it. The other three admitted to it, but just finishing off on the other two, interesting, because they've both got links with Strathallan School. And I've been a governor at Strathallan School for 12 years now, and I never knew anything about this. But one of them, Gavin Harold Russell Vernon, he went on to be a a Scottish engineer. He studied electrical engineering when he was in Glasgow. And it was Ian Hamilton approached him and he asked him if he would take part in this daring plan to... So he, again, another staunch nationalist, he agreed that he would. But what I think is really interesting about Gavin Vernon was that on Christmas Eve 2000, so that would be the 50th anniversary of when the students took the stone, Vernon was invited back to Westminster Abbey. It was specially opened up for him with the words, "Welcome back, Mr. Vernon."
I think that's lovely. And the other wee thing, one of the things in Kay Matheson's suitcase of bits and pieces was the her invitation to Gavin Vernon's 21st birthday party. And the invitation was in the shape of the Stone of Destiny.
Oh,
and well. So was his 21st birthday cake, apparently.
Well, another of these stories that's associated with what really is the Enigma Stone, all these myths and legends and stories. But the final one is perhaps the most interesting one of the four students, and he was called Alan Stewart, and he went on to become a very well-respected Glasgow businessman, and he lived and worked in Glasgow for most of his life. Again, he had been at school at Strathallan when war broke out, so he's another Strathallian. But what I find absolutely fascinating about him was that he wasn't actually a strong nationalist. He was never a convinced nationalist. And so when Ian Hamilton approached him and said, you know, look, we've got this plot to steal the stone, he said, well, it sounded like an exciting way to spend the Christmas period. So he did it for fun, not for any convictions.
But he also was very interesting to them because he had access to his mother's car. So there's your getaway car.
Yeah, that's what he was needed for. Everybody has their function. And he kept them laughing all the way because he seemingly enjoyed a lot of fun. So good one to have in the party.
Yeah, and then, of course, it had to go back down to London, to Westminster. And there it stayed until 1996, when there were great negotiations to bring it back up to Scotland permanently and sort of legally and officially. So... plans were made to bring it up to Scotland, which it was done 1996, which is, I've always got to work this out, 700 years after it was taken down to London.
Yeah, in great pomp and ceremony. It was returned on St Andrew's Day. And another little story, when I started guiding, I used to work a lot with a company that had a driver who had formerly been a policeman. And he was one of the policemen in the police escort that escorted the stone back to Scotland, because, of course, this was huge pomp and ceremony. 10,000 people lined the Royal Mile in Edinburgh to see the Stone of Destiny return in 1996.
Which, again, just shows, although it had been out of the country for 700 years, it still meant so much to Scottish people. It wasn't just a bit of stone coming back. It was their heritage, their history. It was very symbolic of the nation.
Yeah, in fact, when it came back, there was a service at St Giles Cathedral, and the moderator of the Church of Scotland formally accepted the stone's return. And in his speech, he said it would strengthen proud distinctiveness of the people of Scotland. So that kind of sums up the place that this stone holds in the nation.
And again, Gavin Vernon, one of the students, he attended that ceremony. So it's just everything, just all links together really nicely.
And another wee story as well, we think of the stone coming up with this police escort and the vehicle bringing it up. But the van that went down from Edinburgh to Westminster to collect the stone, it wasn't empty. It actually contained, if you've ever been to St Andrews and visited the museum in St Andrews, the St Andrews sarcophagus, which is a beautiful 9th century Pictish masterpiece that's in St Andrews Cathedral. And it was going down to the British Museum for a big exhibition that was going on there. So we had St Andrews sarcophagus going down to the English and Stone of Destiny coming back to the Scots.
All very thrifty. Why take an empty vehicle down? So it was very, very, very Scottish sort of bit of transportation.
So, of course, what this makes this relevant today is that the stone will once again be coming north because it was agreed when, sorry, it won't be coming north. It was agreed when it came north to Edinburgh that whenever it was needed for a coronation, it would go back down to Westminster. So, of course, it's going to be going back down to Westminster.
Yes, but when you read about how they actually managed to, you know, with ropes and pulleys and all sorts and practices with bits and pieces to bring it back, bring it up from Westminster, it's a big, big operation. It's not just like the students, you know, trying to lift it and then putting it on a raincoat. It's a huge sort of mechanical, sort of, you know, mathematical exercise to lift the stone and take it down safely. And it's still, I was at the castle just this week, Liz, and I said to one of the stewards, oh, is the stone still there for people to see? And she said, yes. I said, oh, I just wondered if it was going down. I suppose, you know, it'll be going down quite soon. And she said, oh, we can't say for security reasons. We don't know when it's actually going to go down. I would think it'll go in a plain brown envelope, so nobody knows what it is.
It's going to have to be a lot of brown paper. I mean, it's a muckle great chunk of rock. Yes. You know, it's 152 kilograms. I don't know what that is in old money and pounds and ounces, but it's a big block of stone. So it's going back down to Westminster. But then, of course, it will come back again, as agreed. It'll come back to Scotland, but perhaps it won't come back to Edinburgh Castle immediately, because there's been agreement that in 2024, which isn't too far away now, it will actually go right back to where it all started, close to Scone. It's a big Scone. Close to Scone, it's going to come as the centrepiece for a new £26.5 million renovation of Perth City Hall Museum.
Which I'm really looking forward to that when it's complete, because there's so much history in Perth and so many artefacts. It will be just so relevant to that. And having the Stone of Scone as the centrepiece is just wonderful.
Yep. So whether or not you believe it's the real stone, whether or not you believe it's a load of rubbish and there's no such thing as the Stone of Destiny, it's still very much a part of British history. And when you watch the coronation ceremony, then have a look underneath the seat. You'll see this big block, and it's still part of the coronation of British monarchs.
That's right. And it is so precious. They even believed during World War II that it might be a target, you know, that the Hitler's army might target it as much as Edward I's army did, that it was such a precious symbol of nationhood. So it was hidden under the coffins in the cathedral.
What an exciting life it's led, eh?
Hasn't it just? But I like the James Bond bit about the World War II, Liz. Did you like that bit about the, you know, only a handful of people knew the hiding place of the stone?
Yes.
And they drew up three maps to show the location in case those handful of people were all killed. Mm-hmm. But they sent two in sealed envelopes to Canada, two of the location maps to Canada. And when they got word that they had been safely received, they destroyed the one that was left in London. I just think it's so James Bond, isn't it?
It's a lot of bother to go to if it's just a lump of Scone stone. You know, it's the stuff of films. And of course, so many films have been made about it as well. But I think we should move on to our word of the week, Helen. Do you have a word of the week?
Well, yes, we've been talking all the time about the stone of destiny. Well, in Scotland, a lovely word for a stone, maybe not quite as large as the Stone of Destiny, is a chucky. You just talk about a chucky, you throw a few chuckies into the burn to see them splashing. A stone, a chucky.
Yeah, you put chuckies on your drive.
Yes.
That's Chucky's gravel, that sort of thing. Well, one of the stories, another of the stories that's attached with it, is that when the monks were in the church at Scone and they heard Edward's army approaching, they thought, oh goodness, what are we going to do? And they thought, look for the closest bit of stone that you might be fooled by. And so sitting on top of the cesspit, keeping the lid down, was a great big lump of stone. So one of the myths associated with it was that the stone that Charles will be sitting over actually was holding down the lid of the cesspit. And in Scotland, we would call it a cludgy, a toilet, the cludgy. So it's the cludgy stain.
I'll never be able to look at that stone again, Liz. Especially when Charles is sitting on it. Is he sitting on the kludgy?
And on that note, I think we should close it down for today. Okay. Thanks, Ellen.
Bye, thank you, Liz. Bye.
Bye.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the loo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.